Hello and welcome to the BS History Podcast. My name is BS Dreyer, and whether or not those initials are fitting, I'll let you judge. Today I wanted to talk a little bit about Indonesia. It is a country that is often overlooked despite its very large population and its relatively large size. Now, there are many reasons why Indonesia is an often overlooked country, but it is a very important country. It is by far the largest Muslim majority country in the world in terms of population size, with about 220 million people spread out over 19,000 islands. It is a pretty vast country when you put it into those kinds of perspectives. And it's also an odd country because it is a relatively new country. The reason why it's a relatively new country is, of course, because Indonesia as a single political entity did not exist until the Dutch rolled around and proclaimed the establishment of the Dutch colony of the Dutch East Indies. Now, before the Dutch rolled around, there had been some sort of empires slash kingdoms who had encompassed quite large parts of what is today modern-day Indonesia. But the Dutch were the first to effectively conquer all of it, and even then, the Dutch actually only accomplished the conquering of the totality of modern-day Indonesia a few decades before Indonesia gained its independence. So when thinking about Indonesia as a country, you might picture kinds of rituals and ancient, you know, myths and dances and music and shadow puppet theater that the country is known for. But those pictures that you have are likely only from parts of the country. It's either from the main island of Java, or it might be from Bali, which is a popular tourist destination, but probably not a full picture of the entire country, which, as I said, encompasses so many more people and a very large territory. Just to further put it into perspective, if you look at Indonesia on a map today, you will notice that it looks quite a lot smaller than it actually is. The reason, of course, is that the Mercator projection, if you don't know what that is, I suggest you look it up because it's very fascinating. But the Mercator projection, of course, makes everything around the equator so much smaller. Indonesia lies basically right on top of the equator, making it so much smaller to us when we look at a standard world map than it actually is. Indonesia, if you consider the country as it's connected by its own waters, then it's a country that is covering an area that is as wide as Europe or the United States. So it is a very, very large country, not just because of its population size, but because of its actual area. And of course, within that actual area are all these natural resources. Those natural resources are, of course, what drew the attention of Europeans in the first place, and the Dutch were the ones who were, should we say, lucky enough, in a sense at least, to gain control over that massive area with all those natural resources. The process of the Dutch taking over Indonesia actually starts about 3 centuries before Indonesian independence. And the Dutch, who were the first to arrive in the Dutch East Indies, as they would later be known, were company employees. And for a very long time, the Dutch presence in the Dutch East Indies, in the 17th century, the Dutch set up a company called the United East Indies Company. It was one of the first great sort of multinational companies in the world. It was publicly traded, and it was really an astonishing achievement in commerce, to be sure. And over the next couple of centuries, the Dutch and their international employees and collaborators from all around, primarily Europe. Well, they set up a bunch of different ports and harbors and trading posts around the Indonesian archipelago. The Dutch, for this period in history, really focused on spices. They focused on trade, and they wanted to control the areas that they could gain the most from. So they controlled huge parts of the island of Java, where the capital of the Dutch East Indies, which was called Batavia. Today it is the capital of modern day Indonesia and it's called Jakarta, but that's where that city lies, on that island of Java, famous for coffee of course, but it also produces so many other things, particularly spices, which were of course highly valued commodities. The Dutch controlled or had direct control over parts of the much larger island of Sumatra and the spice islands of the Moluccas. And they also had various ports on various smaller and larger islands around the Indonesian archipelago. By the end of the 19th century, however, as the rest of the European powers were scrambling for the goods in Africa and elsewhere, the Dutch also sort of, in a sense, reluctantly decided that they needed to get in on the ground floor in the whole empire building enterprise that was so popular with European powers at the time. This is of course also the kind of mentality that led, among other things, the Germans to suddenly want an empire, which they really expanded on during the latter half of the 19th century under Prussian rule. Part of the myth surrounding this part, this time period in European imperialism, is of course that it was kind of a reluctant imperialism that they were engaging in. It was an imperialism of necessity. And in the case of countries such as Britain and the Dutch, who already had some possessions that they hadn't fully gained control over or hadn't fully sort of subjugated, that it was now their duty, or that they, because of external pressures within Europe, needed to consolidate that power. Well, they had to engage in imperialism. They had to subjugate any rulers, indigenous rulers, that might challenge their authority in these colonies. And the Dutch were very much part of this. And so they, in the 1870s, began a campaign to sort of root out any and all troublesome native leaders. First on the list is the Sultanate of Aceh on the island of Sumatra, and the Dutch narrowly beat these people, even though the Dutch are armed with the latest in European war technology, and the people of the Aceh Sultanate are genuinely only armed with spears and swords and knives, basically. And the people of the Aceh Sultanate employ tactics that would later prove very detrimental to even the United States Army in Vietnam. It's guerrilla warfare, it's traps, it's just generally very dirty warfare. It's the kind of warfare that you also see when the Americans decide that they need to consolidate their newfound empire in places such as the Philippines. All in all, it was a horrid and expensive business to consolidate empire. It wasn't necessarily a net gain, but the Dutch sort of bought into this fantasy that you could possibly control Indonesia, the Dutch East Indies, and make them a profitable colony, while also at the same time sort of achieving some of the Enlightenment goals that Europeans had been obsessed with since, well, the Enlightenment, of, you know, human equality and trying to better educate and indeed enlighten the people of the Dutch East Indies, bring them into modernity, in other words. And whether it was luck that the Aceh people had been able to sort of hold off the Dutch for as long as they had, or whether it was just Dutch incompetence and they learned their lesson, I can't say for sure, but after that the Dutch began to really get the hang of it, so to speak. they started to consolidate their power in a more effective way. And how they did that? Well, they started playing off the internal sort of religious and ethnic and indeed class society strife that was inherent within the different societies across the Indonesian archipelago. By the end of the 19th century, the Dutch East Indies looked a lot more like modern-day Indonesia, and the Dutch suddenly found themselves very hands-on in the rule over the people of the islands, where before they had been primarily a sort of business partner to the local rulers and people who would trade with the local population. Now they were in not just name, but indeed in deed and in law, the rulers of the Dutch East Indies. They had to be there and they had to maintain a presence. A curious thing about the Dutch rule, their mode of empire building or rule over a colony, is something that was remarked upon also within Europe, and that is that the Dutch tended to gravitate towards accepting and even adopting local customs when they could fit with the Dutch worldview. So some things, such as the idea that administrators should have these very large entourages that they traveled with, and that they should have these characteristic Indonesian aristocratic golden umbrellas, well, that all stems from that idea that you will be better able to rule and to trade and to do things with the native population if you at least do some semblance of adopting their way of life. It's the kind of same mentality to a certain extent that allowed the Dutch to have a trading outpost in Japan when Japan closed off its country to any and all other Christian powers, because other Christian powers, the Portuguese, were the ones who were first to Japan and were the ones that sort of instigated that lockout that Japan had. Well, those powers wanted to Christianize the Japanese and indeed succeeded to some extent, but the Dutch were happy to shed their ships of all, you know, crucifixes and anything else, as long as they could trade with the Japanese. And that kind of pragmatism is perhaps some of what characterized the Dutch administration in the Dutch East Indies colony. And it's also an interesting point about the Dutch rule that the Dutch themselves very much had a sort of different hierarchy within the Dutch who were in Indonesia. You had the ones who were the pure, the ones who maintained Dutch tradition and who wore still Dutch clothes and only succumbed, so to speak, to native traditional indigenous rituals, etc., when it was necessary for business. And then you had stayers, so-called, because they themselves or their parents or even parents' parents, etc., many generations back, had in fact been stationed and working in Indonesia. Some of these Dutch people were Dutch in pretty much all but language and name, but had their whole life experience growing up in Indonesia, and they tended to gravitate more towards not only wearing Indonesian clothes, but also adopting some Indonesian cultural practices. Some of them, such as multiple marriages and that kind of thing, was very much frowned upon by the more conservative parts of Dutch society, which were indeed very Protestant and therefore, well, should we say, a little bit more reserved at the very least than the kind of culture that they would meet in Indonesia. Now, I mention all of this not to paint some kind of rosy picture of life under Dutch colonial rule. It was not that they were somehow more morally responsible or closer to the native population than other European powers were. There were good people and bad people, as is pretty much always the case throughout history. To this day, many Dutch people will tell you that their government instituted ethical policies in the Indonesian colonies, and that they did so out of a wish to better the lives of their colonial subjects. And there were undoubtedly colonial administrators, teachers, etc., people in the colonies who very much wanted this for the local population. But there are two strikes against that argument. First of all is that the kind of teachers that were genuinely supportive of the local population, which were generally socialists or later on communists, well, as soon as they were found out to have such political leanings, they were sent right back home to Holland, where they came from. So that's kind of a little bit of a myth. There definitely were that kind of person, but the actual colonial administration was not in favor of that sort of radical, at least radical betterment of the lives of their colonial subjects. And secondly, of course, was that the administration sort of fostered the creation of this quite heavy-handed, say, local police force or spy department slash rolled all into one, which they used to subjugate the colonial subjects. And while there may not have been the kind of corporal horrific punishment that you saw in the Belgian Congo, there were definitely instances of undue violence at the hands of the Dutch. The Indonesians definitely did suffer, there can be no doubt. That is not to say that the achievements of some Dutch people who worked in the colonies, such as those working with public health or those working with protecting persecuted minorities within Indonesian societies, were not a kind of a colonial hero, if you will. They were definitely good people. But again, the administration, the colonial government itself, was very much allied with the existing ruling aristocracies that were in Indonesian society at the time, and they utilized those class society type feudal almost strata within society in order to maximize their rule, because even at the height of Dutch colonial rule, there were relatively few Dutch people within the Dutch East Indies compared to how many native indigenous Indonesians there were. So ruling them, you did need somebody else to do your work for you. So the aforementioned police slash spy department, that was pretty much all local Indonesians. The kind of rulers that the Indonesians would meet day to day, the government administrators, etc., were mostly kind of recruited from the aristocratic levels of Indonesian society. And in that way, you can kind of argue that the Dutch practice of getting very close to the native way of life may have been a bad choice, particularly when considering some of the practices that the aristocratic class within Indonesia engaged in both before and after the Dutch arrived in the archipelago. It was generally not a nice thing to be anybody but on the top levels of society, and that of course is a thing that holds true, unfortunately, even to this day in many countries. But it was definitely true in Indonesia as well, and for a peasant farmer, it would have made kind of very little difference, honestly, whether you were ruled by the Dutch or the local aristocracy. In all but name, at least, the aristocracy was far removed from your own world. They might speak your language, but the kind of ritual and the kind of things that the aristocracy did in order to project their power onto the population definitely alienated them from said population. However, as bad as the aristocracy had been before the Dutch rule, and as bad as parts of the aristocracy continued to be under Dutch colonial rule, it was also from the aristocracy, from these few educated men, and in some cases women, that we found the very first kind of patriot of an actual modern coherent political entity of Indonesia. Remember, most of these people from the aristocracy that forms the basis of early Indonesian nationalism, well, they come from long lines of people in ruling families within particular islands with particular traditions, sometimes even particular religions. You have to remember that on islands such as Bali, it was Hindus that generally ruled, even though the majority of population was Muslim. In places like Sumatra, it was generally Muslims who ruled, etc. So you had sultans, kings, etc., etc., different titles, different little kingdoms and fiefdoms, etc., spread throughout all of the islands, and it had never been a true coherent political entity until the Dutch rolls around and decide that it must be, because that makes it easier for the Dutch. Well, that also made it easier for the Indonesians to gather up momentum to resist Dutch rule. And that resistance really comes in force when the Second World War is looming, and after some particularly bad scandals within the colonial setting, among them a scandal around purchasing sex from underage boys, during which, of course, the majority of the people convicted were indeed Dutch people, but they received much more lenient sentences than some of the other people convicted in the same case, including Indonesians and Chinese people. And of course, that also further illustrates the kind of racially divided society that existed under Dutch rule, which for all intents and purposes was still an incredibly racist project, no matter how much of a sort of ethical slash betterment of the indigenous population spin you want to put on it. There were definitely very different treatments based on where you were from, what kind of heritage you had, and the Dutch in this case, as well as every other case, lucked out, so to speak. With the advent of the Second World War, the communication and transports between the colonies and Holland were cut off, and although conditions did not really improve under Japanese occupation for the Indonesian population, it certainly got a hell of a lot worse for the Dutch people in Indonesia, many of whom died in prisoner of war camps. Oddly enough, following the end of the Second World War, the Dutch seemed, by and large, to sort of assume that the Indonesians would welcome back Dutch rule, which was, of course, not at all the case. In 1945, a group of nationalist leaders, including Indonesia's future first president Sukarno, had proclaimed Indonesian independence from the Dutch. And after that, there were about 4 years of armed struggle until the Dutch finally caved and realized that they could not possibly hold Indonesia any longer. And in 1949, Indonesia was officially established as its own country, one of the first in the wave of decolonization that happened after the end of the World War, the Second World War, that is. Of course, the trouble for the Indonesian population writ large was not over with the end of the Dutch colonial period. Sukarno might have been a nationalist and remembered as a hero of Indonesian independence, but he also moved the country, or at least the presidency, more towards authoritarianism. When the military leader Suharto led a coup against Sukarno and succeeded in becoming the next president of Indonesia, things did not get any better for a very long time. Besides a truly horrific purge of any communist and or suspected communist under Suharto's rule, it was also a dictatorship that lasted about 3 decades. Now, entering the new millennium, however, Indonesia has finally achieved a kind of stable democracy, and although there is a push and pull between more religious conservative people within Indonesia and those who adhere to a more secular and modernist view of how Indonesia should be governed, things are indeed the best that they have ever been in Indonesia. And here's hoping that things will only continue to get better. And with said sentiment having been expressed, I think it's time to end today's episode. You can find me on Twitter at BSHistoryPod and reach out with any questions and comments if you feel like it. And last but not least, thank you so very much for listening.